Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Goodness.
Ladies and
gentlemen. Was that really necessary?
Yeah, Garrett did not know I was going to do that, which I told him before we started, you're not going to be ready for this, but he didn't know what I was talking about.
I'm going to have to see what that sounds like before I go and drop that.
This is the grand finale.
The ultimate, if you would say.
You know, last time, the penultimate, for those of you who had our little...
vocabulary lesson.
Word of the day, yeah. Penultimate.
Yeah.
Now we are finally, it's been over a year.
Yeah, it's like been like a year and 2 months that we've been trekking through the Exodus.
Yeah, and part of that's, you know, because of our timing on, they were like every week, and then they were like every 2 weeks, and then they kind of.
Life situations.
Life happens. And so we are finally here, and we are, you know, it's kind of a.
It's exciting.
It is exciting.
We've gone like that. This has been a lot. It's hard to pick a book and just say, you know what, we're gonna stick with it. We're gonna figure out its themes. We're gonna see what it has to say to us as a whole. It's difficult. It's harder than just picking one, you know, one verse and being like, oh, let's just talk about that one verse. Like this is, we have dedicated ourselves to the book of Exodus, and we did it.
Yeah,
like this is it. So
just to think about having read the whole book like basically two times, because you know, we do our own studying and then we read it on the podcast. I mean, it's just like, this is definitely the longest book that I've studied in this way,
yeah,
in this level of depth, and like in a continuous,
yeah,
you know, like over a stretch of time. And
but surely
it's
like
taught me the most.
I think that's just one thing to note of like,
yeah,
sure, I think you've learned more about the Bible in this reading than you maybe ever have in your life. And I think it's not because of, you know, like it's because we've just been taking it in context and reading it as the story as it presents itself to us, as, and not just trying to rip out the things that we like or what we want to hear. Actually hearing God on God's own terms is what teaches us about him. And so, yeah.
Yeah, so we're excited to jump into the last and chapter 40. But of course, before we do that, we have to play Chick-fil-A.
Table topics.
Roulette. I think we do that differently every time.
Yeah.
So we're down at the last two cards here, and I don't think we've done these before, but there's...
We'll see if we've done it before. All right, so I'll go first. Let's see here. If you were planning the best playground in the world, what would you include in it? I feel like we'd kind of done that. Wasn't it like
it was
a treehouse?
It was a treehouse. Yeah, I think I had the treehouse one. This is a playground.
Yeah.
Remember, this is for you. It's not for me.
I know. I mean, I don't know what would be. I feel like the best playground in the world for me is a golf course. So I would just have a golf course.
You're missing the point of the question.
It's a big playground.
It's a big playground.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Caleb is a big fan of the golf carts, so.
Yeah, I would go with, the best playground for me is a golf course. There you go. That's what I would include in it.
What would it? Yeah, just a playground?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah. So there you go.
Just a golf course,
yeah.
Not any other, no swings, no slides.
No.
Okay. What's the best costume you've ever seen? Huh. Well, you know, this is probably not the best costume I've ever seen, but the one that just pops into my head. What?
I'm just thinking of Bridget, your friend.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I my former manager when I worked at Blue Cross, she and her husband, they would make like these amazing costumes, like go to legit events and like be able to like enter in a costume contest, and it was for different things. Like they did the Mandalorian, I think most recently I saw on her Instagram or something, but they had done a lot of other he had done the Winter Soldier, and they like make these costumes themselves and stuff, and they look so cool.
Yeah,
and like,
just straight it looks at spitting
like
image
from the movie
of the Mandalorian picture.
Well, that's way better than what I had in mind.
What did you have in mind?
It's not the best costume I've ever seen, but when I read this question and I thought of costume, it's for some reason what popped into my head was this guy at the turkey trot that had like,
oh, the big turkey.
You know, some people dress like a turkey, but this was like more elaborate than most of the ones. Right. And so like the turkey trot where we live, it's like you start out running uphill, and so this guy has like these turkey wings all around his body that are made out of like cardboard, and all I'm thinking as I'm running up that hill is like, what is the wind resistance gotta be like on that?
I can't imagine running 5 miles.
I would like
that.
Yeah, like I'd be dead just like trying to run up the first hill with that on. But for some, I don't know why that popped into my head, but that was just like
I feel like some friends of ours that are in the Yak group, they did a really good
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. I really liked that their costume. I've never been particularly good at, well, just really in general creative things, and so I've never really I mean, the best costumes for me have probably been bought at Walmart.
Yeah, same. You know? I mean, yeah, like I have not attempted to like make the kids their Halloween costumes.
Yeah.
We just buy them at parties.
I actually can't remember the last costume I wore. I have a Captain America shirt that I wear for Halloween every year.
Yeah.
It's just
it's better than it sounds. Okay.
Like, it's just a shirt that
it has a hood on it though that like kind
of, it reveals my ripped abs.
Oh my goodness. It has a hood on it that has like makes it where he kind of has a little bit of a mask sort of thing, even though Captain America doesn't really have a mask.
He does. He does, and I guess once everybody knows of him as Steve Rogers, sure, but he originally wore the mask.
Yeah, you know? I guess that's true. Well, it's more like
Batman half mask.
Yeah, it's more like a security helmet thing,
right?
Too.
Security helmet.
Well, you know what I mean. I'm in military.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Not just
He had that on top of it.
Yeah, so, the costume one. We definitely haven't had that one before. So that's...
Oh, but separately, Sadie has informed us that she wants to be Elsa this year, which I cannot stand Elsa. She's probably my least favorite Disney character.
Okay, don't get him wrong. He loves the soundtrack to Frozen.
I like Frozen
and he likes
as a
Frozen
soundtrack.
And he really likes
I just think that
movie.
Elsa is extremely overrated and she's very self-centered. And it's not exactly, I mean, I just don't want to teach my kids that everything is about them.
Yeah.
And that's what Elsa thinks that every moment of every part of that movie is about her. And besides, I'm sitting here wondering whenever you've got, I mean, this is going to be spoilers. So if you haven't seen Frozen 2 by now, I'm sorry.
Frozen 2.
But, you know, it's like this whole thing of all the different elemental spirits or whatever. And it's like fire and earth,
wind,
and
water,
yeah, wind,
heart,
wind,
by our
well,
powers combined.
What? No, stop, you're getting ahead of me. So, the elements are like, yeah, fire, earth, wind, and water, and it's like looking for the fifth element, you know, if you will, like it feels like very fifth element type thing. And it does take me to Captain Planet, and it's like, but what it feels like the way that the movie goes is like trying to figure out that fifth element, and Elsa just like inserts herself in the middle of it. It's like, oh, of course, the fifth element is ice. It's like, no, if anything, like that's part of water. If it's part of anything, and what would be the fifth thing? We'll go to Captain Planet, and Captain Planet will tell you that it's heart. Or love. And who in this in this has the most heart? And it's Anna, and Anna gets no credit.
Garrett,
and I'm so
in
tired
with
of that.
The hot takes.
I'm sorry.
Just,
if you like Elsa, I'm sorry you're self-centered and that you think everything is about you, but it's not, okay? And you know, it's Anna is a better character because
she makes it
about everybody else.
Let's just get this on the record. Are you saying that Sadie is self-centered?
What do you think? Yeah. She comes to you every single day begging for things, and it's because she watches Frozen.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with that she's two, almost three.
It has nothing to do with her being a three-year-old. It has everything to do with you let her watch Frozen. Mm-hmm. And now she wants to be Elsa, who's self-centered and cares nothing about, you know, nobody but herself. Yeah, I'm just saying.
Sadie's in a big girl bed now, and so she'll come downstairs in the morning, stand next to, you know, that do that creepy, like, come up to your face while you're asleep, and just you open your eyes, and there she is. And she'll be like, Mama, I want milk! And yeah, that's like exactly. The first thing she says to me. Elsa. So maybe you're onto something
it's
there.
It's Elsa.
I don't know.
It's Elsa coming out in her.
Well, so didn't expect this to go into a hot take on Elsa, but...
Yeah, but it did.
But and, it did.
You know, so, you can just handle that truth as you see fit. You know, the truth is the truth whether you like it or not. All right, so speaking of the truth, all right, so getting back into Exodus, our final chapter. So I'm going to just try to really quickly recap the story. And that is that, so far in the whole biblical story, God chose one peoples through whom he was going to rescue all of creation, that he's going to bless all the nations through Abraham and his family. And that family finds itself, at the beginning of the Exodus narrative, finds itself in Egypt where they have been made slaves. They don't, that Pharaoh never didn't remember what they had done for them before, anything about Joseph, and instead fears them. And because he fears them, he enslaves them to try to grind them out and makes their life bitter. And the way the story went was that they cried out to God, and he heard them. And whenever he heard them, he chose one through whom he was going to rescue Israel. And he revealed himself to him. And then through his actions, his actions with Egypt as well as with Israel, God, through this story, has made himself known for who he is. That he is first and foremost a redeemer. That he hears the cries of the broken. That he's a promise keeper. That he's keeping his promises to Abraham, that he has compassion on his people. And he's not going to put up with people oppressing his children. And he has compassion on them, and he delivers them through his judgments. You know, Pharaoh gets what's coming to him, what Pharaoh invited on himself. I mean, one of the main themes, Exodus chapter 5, Pharaoh says, who is Yahweh that I should listen to him? I don't know this Yahweh. And so Yahweh makes himself known to Pharaoh through his judgments and through his actions. He, through the same exact actions, he both redeems Israel as well as pours out judgment on Egypt and makes himself known to both peoples. And through that, he will also make himself known to the nations. And so these things can't really be separated. They're one and the same. Yahweh is being made known both through his mercies and through his judgments. And so we just have to live in that perceived tension. And he delivers his people out into the wilderness. He's going to bring them to Sinai. They grumble against him and they don't like Moses and they have frustrations as they get in the desert. But Yahweh is a compassionate God who looks after his people in the wilderness, and he eventually brings them to Sinai, where he makes a covenant with them, and he marries them at Sinai. And he says, one of the main things of the Torah is that it's revealing God's character to his people and what he, based off of their redemption, the way that they should respond to that. It's not a works-based, you know, redemption. I've tried to highlight that along the way of like, look, this isn't, the Old Testament isn't about, you know, works then grace or works then salvation. It's not works-based salvation. It's actually, it's fundamentally God delivers them without them having to do anything. But what we see in the story is a response to God because of that, that it generates in them a desire to follow him. Well, he establishes that covenant with them and marries them at Sinai. And he starts giving the tabernacle instructions to Moses so that he can come and dwell among them. That's in chapter 25. That he says, build me a sanctuary so that I can come and dwell among them. And we went through all of that. And all of those instructions. And then Exodus 32, everything seems like it's about to crumble down whenever the Israelites build the golden calf and they worship it and ascribe to it that which Yahweh has done. And it feels like it's all coming down, and Moses intercedes for the people. And there's five kind of different instances of his intercession for and on behalf of the people. And it is effective, and he makes atonement in some way for the people. And Yahweh agrees that he's still going to come and dwell among them despite what they've done. So we see this this forgiver of iniquities. That's part of his character. Exodus 34, Yahweh, Yahweh, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loyal love and faithfulness, keeping loyal love to thousands and forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but not letting the guilty go unpunished to the third and the fourth generation. So we see these things. His character is being poured out in the story, and he's a forgiver of the iniquities of the Israelites. And so he reestablishes, he reengages with them, and he says, I'm going to come and dwell among you. And the tabernacle is finally being built. And that's where we arrive in Exodus chapter 40. We have reached the climax of the book. And in this, the two things are the two major themes that I've seen throughout the Exodus is that God desires to make himself known, and he desires to dwell in and among his people. And so in Exodus chapter 40, we'll see how that kind of comes to its completion. Right. So you're starting the reading?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Then the Lord said to Moses, set up the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, on the first day of the first month. Place the ark of the testimony in it and shield the ark with the curtain. Bring in the table and set out what belongs on it. Then bring in the lampstand and set up its lamps. Place the gold altar of incense in front of the ark of the testimony, and put the curtain at the entrance to the tabernacle. Place the altar of burnt offering in front of the entrance to the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. Place the basin between the tent of meeting and the altar, and put water in it. Set up the courtyard around it, and put the curtain at the entrance to the courtyard. Take the anointing oil and anoint the tabernacle and everything in it. Consecrate it and all its furnishing, and it will be holy. Then anoint the altar of burnt offering and all its utensils. Consecrate the altar, and it will be most holy. Anoint the basin and its stand, and consecrate them. Bring Aaron and his sons to the entrance to the tent of meeting, and wash them with water. Then dress Aaron in the sacred garments, anoint him, and consecrate him, so he may serve me as priest. Bring his sons and dress them in tunics. Anoint them just as you anointed their father, so they may serve me as priests. Their anointing will be to a priesthood that will continue for all generations to come. Moses did everything just as the Lord commanded him.
And I'm going to pick up in 17.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the first month of the second year, on the first of the month, the tabernacle was set up. And Moses raised the tabernacle, and he placed its bases, and he set up its frames. And he placed its bars, and he raised its pillars. And he spread the tent over the tabernacle. He placed the covering of the tent over it, above it, as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And he took and he put the testimony into the ark, and he placed the poles on the ark, and he put the atonement cover on the ark above it. And he brought the ark into the tabernacle, and he set up the curtain of the screening and the shield, the ark, and he shielded the ark of the testimony as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And he put the table in the tent of assembly on the north side of the tabernacle outside the curtain. And he arranged on it an arrangement of bread before Yahweh as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And he placed the lampstand in the tent of assembly opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle. And he set up the lamps before Yahweh, as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And he placed the gold altar in the tent of assembly before the curtain. And he turned fragrant incense into smoke on it, as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And he set up the entrance screen for the tabernacle, and the altar of burnt offering he placed at the entrance of the tabernacle on the tent of assembly, and he offered on it the burnt offering and the grain offering, as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And he placed the basin between the tent of assembly and the altar, and he put there water for washing. And Moses and Aaron and his sons washed their hands and their feet from it. And they're going into the tent of assembly. Right, they're going to the tent of assembly. And at their approach to the altar, they washed as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And he set up the courtyard all around the tabernacle and the altar. And he put up the screen of the gate of the courtyard. And Moses completed the work. And the cloud covered the tent of assembly, and the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle. And Moses was unable to go into the tent of assembly because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle. And when the cloud was lifted from the tabernacle, the Israelites set out on their journeys. But if the cloud was not lifted, they did not set out until the day of its being lifted. For the cloud of Yahweh was on the tabernacle by day, and fire on it by night, before the eyes of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys.
Okay, so we had just spent the, what was it? Four chapters? Well, how many chapters did we do in the last podcast?
Was it 35 through 39.
All right, so we had just spent all those chapters going over again, like these individual pieces of the tabernacle and how the people had come together and, you know, provided the materials that they needed and were really working together to build these pieces to the exact specifications that God had, that we had already read about, that God told Moses about when they were on the mountain together. And so all of that is leading up to this moment where it's like, okay, everything's been built. Or
all the individual parts
have are here now. Yeah. They've been assembled in some way. And now it's just about like the finishing touches of putting it together. None of what happens really in this chapter, except for 34 through the end, is really that surprising, because with this is, again, something we've already read before, but in a like, this is what you're going to do sense, instead of a, okay, we're actually doing it.
Right.
Because, you know, like anointing and consecrating everything and, you know, putting things in place to wash their hands and all that stuff we had already talked about when God and Moses had already had this conversation of this is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, this was honestly, for some reason, this was reminding me of when I had Caleb. And probably no one who's listening knows that I had Caleb, well, maybe my mom, if she still listens. I was induced with Caleb because of low amniotic fluid. So I had had all these appointments leading up to being induced with Caleb, where it was like, we're talking about what's going to happen. And like, here, you know, this is the plan for this and blah, blah, blah. And so the day that we finally went in for the induction, you know, for some reason in my head, I thought we might have a conversation again, but it was like, no, I get in there, I sign my name, you know, sign that they can do it, you know, the medical procedures. And then there's like, you know, they're sticking an IV in me to try to work on getting me induced. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is actually happening.
Right.
Like this is,
all the preparation was coming into the moment.
Yeah.
That it had been climaxing towards.
Yeah, and everything up to that point had felt so drawn out and long and just like, you know, kind of like it's hard to read through all the instructions earlier on in Exodus. It had just kind of been like, oh my goodness, is this ever really going to happen? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're doing this.
Right.
Oh, here it's time now.
Right.
Like this big pivotal life event is happening. And I think you could apply that to a lot of, Garrett and I were talking, you could apply that to so many situations of just like a project at work where or getting married, you know, of like you have all these preparations and then all of a sudden it's like, oh wow, we're really doing
this. We're actually at the altar.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what this chapter as we read it kind of reminded me of like, oh, okay. It's like we're actually putting the things together.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like kind of another analogy I was thinking about, because like we mentioned before, Sadie has a big girl bed now. And so I, for like the first time ever, decided I was just going to try to put it together. Garrett's been having to work a lot and stuff, so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to try this. And he always tells me, there's 1,000 pieces in these
things. There are. I mean, you get those freaking boxes that are just full of parts and pieces.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, attach part AA to B. And then, like, I always flip something backwards.
Yeah.
The way it's not supposed to go because I didn't follow the directions as was commanded to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And, yeah. Relatable.
Yeah. And so, but like, I'm always like, there's always a moment where I have I'm so angry because I've realized, actually, you did do this. It like where you got like a step ahead and I had to go back and correct it.
Yeah, well, that was.
Even though you were technically doing it, I had to come up and fix something for you.
I knew that was happening.
Yeah.
I just didn't think it would interfere as much as it did.
Yeah.
Anyways,
that's put together one of those freaking boxes knows what I'm talking about. Well,
if you've ever put any furniture together ever.
Yeah. You have definitely put a part on backwards and you didn't realize it until you were 2 or 3 steps past it.
So anyway, so as I'm sitting there setting up this bed, I've got, you know, all the pieces are there. They've all, you know, I have them laying out on the floor by their, you know, number or letter. And now they've just got to be put together.
Yeah.
Easy peasy.
Yeah.
But that to me was kind of, it kind of resembled this as well, I guess, with that just being such a recent thing that I've done of just how, you know, up and right before chapter 40, it's like, okay, we've got all these pieces that we've gotten together. We have, you know, the ark, we have all these altars, we have the lampstand, we have, I don't know, all the things.
Yeah.
And so now we just have to put it all together,
right.
All kind of put it in place.
As one of my former mentors would say, all we lack is finishing up.
All we lack is finishing up. Yep.
Yeah.
So that's all we had to do in this chapter 40,
yeah,
just a little bit of finishing up. And so that's kind of in a nutshell how I kind of view this chapter, at least through, 33.
Well, and there's something to be said about this, that the tabernacle is more than just the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, each individual piece on its own, we probably talked about this as we went through the tabernacle instructions, but each individual piece, like, serves a purpose, but it can only serve its purpose within the grander whole.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important. I mean, like, this is just the important part of, like, yes, everybody was involved with all that, but there is one. It does seem like it. I think that you found this striking as we read through it, that it, like, this narrative only talks about Moses doing it.
Yeah.
Like, there is one who is the righteous intercessor in the story, is the one that's assembling the holy dwelling of God from all of these individual piece parts. And you know, it's everybody has contributed to that, but now he's the one that's actually kind of putting it in order and establishing it as God's holy dwelling. And so it's just a something to note of that. Look, each part of these things individually can't really serve its purpose without the grander part. It can't, like, the lampstand can't serve its purpose if it's not actually covered by and made into the holy place.
Yeah.
Right. Or the ark isn't going to serve its purpose unless it's within its location within the tabernacle for God to come and dwell. Each of these individual things can't do the things that it's supposed to do and represent unless the other things are there with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think as I reflect on this and I look forward, and I look forward into, like, the way that Ephesians would talk about things. And we've probably talked about this along the way, but, you know, Ephesians would talk about that we collectively as the church are the temple of God being built up. And who's building his church? Who's building his holy dwelling? That is the Messiah, that God is God's dwelling place. It's not just individually us,
mm-hmm.
Because even individual piece parts, me and you, can't serve our greater purpose, if you want to put it that way. Our greater purpose without the collective of all the other parts of the church. I mean, this is what Paul talks about whenever he talks about all the different body parts. Mm-hmm. You know, like he'll use the body as a visual picture of that. That, hey, look, you know, the foot can't yell at the hand kind of thing. It's like, hey, we need, like, we're more than the sum of our individual parts. Mm-hmm. That we're, as a unit, we're actually better together. And that's the same here. I think that this is a shadow looking forward that's going to find its true fulfillment in the church through God's people as we are building up the holy dwelling of God as a collective, more so than the individual. And so I think that's something that we kind of lost. I think over time that we've made this about like you individually being the temple of God. And that's not wrong, but it is, I think that there's more to it in that like we collectively are the holy dwelling of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is kind of looking forward to that. And we've lost the community aspect of it because of how individualistic we are. In desire for, well, you know, I just want to know, but what does God think about me, as opposed to what is God doing for us, for yeah. all of us yeah. that he's concerned for all of his church. So yeah, I see that kind of. That's just one thing that I think about as we read through this.
So I think for me, I would venture to guess that the most impactful verses of this chapter are probably the last, you know, from 34 to 38.
Yeah, so before we get to that, though, just one thing, if you noticed in the reading, whenever you're listening to this, one thing that's continually repeated is that it was as Yahweh commanded Moses. I think that's a major theme of this chapter, is that he did everything as it was commanded by Yahweh. He listened to his voice. This is one of the things of the Torah, of like, hey, if you listen to my voice, then like this is how this is going to go. This is what Peter Inn says. He says, we see not only in this passage, but throughout the tabernacle section, that marked attention is given to the precision by which the tabernacle and its furnishings are to be made, and where precisely the furnishings are to be placed in the tabernacle. This uncompromising attention to details is another indication that the tabernacle is an act of creation. It reflects the order that God originally created in the universe. There is no room for human disorder or for chaos to invade this holy space. Everything must be exactly as God has commanded. The order of the tabernacle reflects God's very nature, a nature that creation itself reflects. And so this is, and so to expand on that thought a little bit, is that yes, through Moses, like Yahweh's doing all this stuff, like kind of through Moses. He's recreating. We've talked about that through the tabernacle. This is a new creation event. And I think we talked some about this last podcast, but in Exodus 33 here, before we get into the next section, it says that, he set up the courtyard around the tabernacle and the altar, and he put up the screen and the gate in the courtyard, and Moses completed the work. This is an echo of God completing his work through the 7 days of creation in Genesis chapter 1. The completion of the work actually occurs in like Genesis 2:1 or 2:2. But it's an echo of that, of reflecting that, hey, this is a new creation event. God is doing something new. It's a renewal of creation, through this tabernacle work. That's what, just one thing I wanted to highlight there. Yeah. So, you have any, what are the other thoughts here?
So for 34 through just the end of the chapter, these last few verses here. Well, first off, I'd like to mention, just going back to what you were saying about how Moses was kind of the one who seems to be very involved in these finishing touches, I guess, if you will. And then it's all all of a sudden it like transitions to like, Moses could not enter the tent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which feels a little bit ironic or just weird, given that he's been the one who has spent so much time with God. All these, like, you know, weeks on the mountain. Two sets of weeks on the mountain. And then just their relationship from the very beginning of just how it's kind of grown.
Well, I just kind of wonder, though, with that, if that is supposed to mean that he's even more fully present in the tabernacle even than he's been
with
Moses on the mountain.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's supposed to be like, look, he's been supposedly in the presence of Yahweh this whole time. It's like and now all of a sudden you can't go in.
Yeah.
Like that's how full of the glory of Yahweh that this is. That whenever the cloud covered the tent of assembly and the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle, that in some sense, this is an even further heightening of God's presence.
Which is especially
than what he even experienced on the mountain.
Which is especially crazy given, you know, when we talked about his radiance on his face shining to the people to where they were just like, yo.
Yeah.
Can you cover that up? We can't.
Yeah.
We can't even stand to look at your glowing radiant face.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a cool little new thought maybe.
I don't know. It's just it's a reflection that I just have looking at it. I'm like, wow, you know, like how full of the glory of God must it be that he can't go in? But I mean this is where the whole story has been going, you know, and everything. I think for me, whenever I look at this from a story arc standpoint, you know, like just thinking in normal storytelling stuff, like my mind always freaking goes to Hitch. I don't know why, but it goes to Hitch because
Garrett,
it's such an easy
big rom com guy.
Yeah, for whatever reason, it's just easy for me to see the plot, like how the plot line works, you know, and most people have seen Hitch, so it's a great example. So anyways, you know, rom-com,
Will Smith movie, this one.
Yeah. Any rom-com, so there's like a relationship that you want to be successful. They have, you know, like there's like this tension in the beginning as they try to work it out and they come to know each other in one way or another. And then every single rom-com has a, or one of your favorite, like, Christmas love movies or something like that.
Okay.
You know?
Shots fired.
Yeah. You know, there's always a moment where it's like, oh, the relationship is in jeopardy. And you've got to work out, like, you know where it's going. Everybody knows where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows, hey, this is going to resolve itself somehow. Mm-hmm. And, but there's a working out of that relationship, and just the same. And then in the end, like you have the, whatever, they live happily ever after, or they, you know, you have, or in Hitch, you have like the marriage scene and things like that. And they're all dancing at the end and everybody's happy. Like, hooray, the relationship worked out. And this is set up the exact same way, you know, like God is revealing himself to his people and he marries them and then everything seems like it's going, you know, it's going down the drain and you're like, what's going to happen? And, you know, God shows who he is, that he bears iniquity. He prefers to carry the sins of his people if they would repent, and they do. And they are outpoured with love and, you know, for each other and for their God who has shown them compassion, and everything is restored. And now we've gotten to the end of the story and God does what we've been waiting for the whole time,
mm-hmm.
that he comes and dwells among his people. This is where it's been going the whole time. Yeah. This is what the Exodus narrative is all about,
mm-hmm.
that God desires to dwell among his people and he will bear their iniquity. In order to do so, like he's not going to put up with sin forever, but he's going to bear that in some way. We don't necessarily know at this point how he bore that burden, you know,
mm-hmm.
but we do know that he clearly has bared the iniquity of his people. He's carried the iniquity of his people and he desires to dwell among them. And there it is. There he has.
Yeah.
And this is where the whole story has always been going, and God dwells among his people.
And to me, this is a great season finale,
yeah.
not series finale,
yeah.
if you will, in terms of like TV shows, because we kind of have this satisfying ending to the book of Exodus where it's like, the Lord is dwelling among his people.
And
this
goes,
is a beautiful thing.
And he goes everywhere with
and
them.
And he's guiding them and everything.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we can't forget that we've been talking a lot about this promised land,
yeah,
this like land flowing with milk and honey, and we're not there yet.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it really does set up great in a sense for like season two.
Well, there's there's kind of two cliffhangers. I think here there's the main cliffhanger that is presented is Moses not being able to go in.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's great that Yahweh has dwelt among his people, but what about Moses not being able to go in? How do I deal with that? Mm-hmm. You know? And so the book naturally does that. That's the way that the Torah works it leaves you hanging to say, well, how do I deal with the fact that Moses can't go in? And that is what the book of Leviticus is all about. The book of Leviticus is all about, how do we get into the tabernacle?
Yeah.
How do we get into God's presence, and what does that look like? Mm-hmm. And so the book of Leviticus is all about, how do we approach God? How do we draw near to God? We talked about that with the offerings, with the korbans. That's the Hebrew word for offering. The root of that is literally to draw near. How do we draw near to God? Right now, Moses is on the outside looking in. How does he draw near to God? Well, the book of Leviticus will handle all of that. Mm-hmm. And so it leaves you with the cliffhanger. While there is a satisfaction that Yahweh is dwelling among his people, you do kind of have like that cut scene at the end. It's like, but he can't go in.
Yeah.
You know? And so for me, it's great storytelling. Like they're leaving you with something, and they're also like giving you a little bit of desire to continue to figure out what happens with this story.
Yeah. But it also does sort of remind me of like the Fellowship of the Ring, where it's like, but we still have to get to this place.
Yeah, exactly. As well, that's true too. Yes.
Of just like, we're in a good spot right now. Things are looking great, you know, for the most part. But like, we still have to get somewhere.
Yeah, we know where the end goal is, because it's been spoken already. Mm-hmm. That I'm going to take you to the land flowing with milk and honey. I'm going to take you into the land of the Jebusites and the Perizzites and the Hivites, all the ites.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do know that's on the horizon somewhere and hasn't been resolved yet.
Right.
But the main arc of this particular story has been resolved.
Yeah.
God dwells in and among his people. Also, just to note, I thought you had a comment just on the fire by day, or I'm sorry, the cloud by day and fire by night stuff.
Yeah. Do you mean about like the protection?
Yeah.
So a thought that I had about, you know, obviously we've talked a lot about the aspect of the cloud and how, well, and really fire too, because the burning bush is kind of where, you know, this all started. But just the cloud has been a big theme, with that representing like God's presence. Mm-hmm. And to me, I was just thinking about this too, in terms of, you know, at night there's this fire, which also produces smoke, which would also kind of be that kind of cloud.
Yeah.
You know, as well. I know it says it's like over the cloud, or fire was in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I was thinking about how like a cloud by day, you know, when I consider where they are, might would kind of cool.
Yeah.
Be a little bit cooling for where they are to have this like, I know it sounds bad to be like, you got a cloud hanging over you or whatever. But in this case of like a protection a little bit, maybe from the sun, of just like the elements and everything. And then a fire by night, which might provide warmth in the evening, or just light for them to just, you know, do whatever they need to do. And so I was just kind of thinking about the aspect of God not only being just with them, but also protecting them.
Yeah.
Well,
this is how he guided them out of Egypt It's that same protective feel of God guiding his people through these two things. It's that's been a consistent thing in the Exodus.
Yeah.
So God is dwelling in and among his people. So do you want to do a quick reflection on your favorite section of this? Mm-hmm.
Probably a lot of people, they might not even know that we normally do this
because it's been so long since we've done it.
But, you know, we've done shorter books before, like Esther and Jonah and Ruth. And and at the end of every book we've done is we've said, what was your favorite part, or what stood out to you the most?
Yeah.
I mean, because obviously there's a lot of great things in here.
Absolutely.
And so for me, like after kind of combing through it again, of just kind of like thinking about what stuck out to me, I had to go with chapter 32. And that is the chapter with the golden calf. But it's not, that sounds kind of horrible.
Well, but that's all people, anybody really knows about.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Like, for the most part, 30, like, well, I don't know that most people even realize that the golden calf is in the Exodus narrative. But,
well, yeah.
You know, like, you know that it existed, but yeah. If you've never really sat down and read the book of Exodus, you don't even know where the golden calf happens and what book, where.
Yeah.
So
for me, though, it's not... it's not specifically, like, I guess before we really dug into this, I thought about the golden calf narrative as being the people created this golden calf and God was really mad about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where my mind stopped.
Yeah.
Like, and yeah, maybe, yeah, they had to reconcile that somehow. Like, that was kind of my thought process around it. But my favorite part, or one of the highlights to me in the entire book of Exodus is Moses's intercession on behalf of the people after the golden calf moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll read a little bit, starting chapter 32, verse 11. But Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. O Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth. Turn from your fierce anger. Relent and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. And so this section just stood out to me. I remember when we were reading it, just like so many light bulbs going off in my mind. For starters, just thinking about Moses's relationship with God from the very beginning of like, well, who am I supposed to tell Pharaoh like you are? Or like, you know, I don't even really know who you are kind of conversation of like,
right.
what am I supposed to say? To fast forward to now, and Moses, who also was concerned about his speaking abilities, mm-hmm. which we've talked about quite a bit and how that has transformed
yeah.
through the Exodus story. He's come so far that now he is actually this man who was once scared to speak to Pharaoh is now telling God who he is, who God is. He's
right.
He is reminding God of God's promises.
Yeah.
He is reminding God of his character, which,
right.
you know, we get more fully into his character in chapter 34. But right here, it's just like this brave person who is interceding on behalf of the people who he disagrees. I mean, later on in this same chapter, I mean, he burns with anger too,
mm-hmm.
just like God did. And so he's taking on the sins of the people and identifying with that sin as though he did it himself.
Yeah.
And he is pleading to God to relent.
Yeah.
And if this sounds familiar, it's because Jesus does that for us on a daily basis. Like, that was the ultimate...
Yeah, this is kind of the template.
Intercessor.
This is the template of what Jesus is going to come to do.
Yeah.
That it's like, hey, this is a shadow of things to come of what the ultimate intercessor will do. Moses was awesome.
Yeah.
In that he did this. And it's not lessening Moses to say that, you know, this was
mm-hmm.
all this was looking forward to what Jesus would do on our behalf, and he would do it to a more extensive level.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a story that helps us get a better picture of what Jesus is actively doing.
Yeah. It personalizes it for me a little bit because, you know, I think about, yeah, part of Jesus dying was for the forgiveness of our sins so that we may have a relationship, you know,
mm-hmm.
so that we may have a relationship with God. And, but I don't really necessarily think about the ways in which, like, you know, sometimes movies or TV shows can kind of like help you see things better. And this was just one of those situations, this narrative helped me see how Jesus, like, in what way he might do that for me specifically.
Yeah.
And so this was just a really neat moment for me. I remember just being like, oh my goodness, this is so obvious why we need an intercessor. Somebody mm-hmm. who, you know, can fully, can be, you know, in God's presence and is also, like, fully with us and supports us,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. and one thing, and this is going to be where my stuff comes from, too. I love 32 through 34. That's been my favorite part of the Exodus. That's been something I didn't know about the Exodus before we really started, you know, reading it and I was researching it. But one thing that I've really loved that comes in some of these scenes is that Moses says that, you know, if I have found favor in your eyes, then, you know, do this for this people. You know, please come and dwell among us. And I just note that Moses doesn't use the favor that he has in God's eyes for his own benefit. He uses it for the benefit of the people. And so just the same, so we talked about this too. The very first book that me and you did in this, you know, in the podcast was with Esther. And Esther very much takes the place of Moses. She plays the Moses character in the book of Esther. That she goes before the king because she has found favor in the eyes of the king. And she says to the king, if I found favor in your eyes, just like Moses says to God, then, you know, do this for my people. Like, don't annihilate my people. And she takes a huge risk by doing that. She knows she's not supposed to go before the king, that she could get herself killed by doing so. And she uses the favor that God or that the king has for her for the benefit of her people. And then that both of those characters come to their, both Moses and Esther come to their culmination in Jesus, where he uses, you know, he uses the favor that he has in the eyes of his father, not for his own benefit, but for the benefit of, you know, his followers. And so, and that's what he's interceding in the garden. That's the huge intercession moment. But my favorite has definitely been triggered right now to be Exodus 34. Well, really right before it. It starts kind of right before it where Moses gets the courage to say, basically, show me your glory. He asks God to show him his glory, and God tells him, I'll show you my goodness. I will cause my goodness to pass over before you. And this is the way that Yahweh proclaims his name before Moses. And he says, and this is the reason for why this is most important to me, or why I like this the most, is because this is the most repeated set of verses in scripture, by scripture, or of scripture. And this is fundamental to who all of the Israelites would look back on and say, this is our God. This is who he is. This is the way that he's described himself. This is who he says he is. Whenever God describes himself, he describes himself in this way. He proclaims his name and he says, Yahweh, Yahweh, God who is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding with loyal love and faithfulness, keeping loyal love to thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. And he does not leave utterly unpunished, punishing the guilt of the fathers on the sons and on the sons and on the sons on the third and the fourth generations. And so, you know, I just, God revealing himself in that way and showing, within here, that his disposition is to forgive and that his desire is to be compassionate and gracious, but he's not going to put up with evil forever. You know, it's not going to be something that he just lets go. So we have to live in that perceived tension. But we, like me and you talked about at the time, like we know that there's not really a tension here. Just the same as we would punish our son for something wrong that he did, it does not remove our compassion for him. Mm-hmm. But our compassion for sure overshadows any punishment that we would put on him for correcting him and for guiding him. This is all very fatherly and very, love that he has for his children, that he's overflowing with. And so, it feels like a tension, but it's not really. But we do need to come to grips with it, is that it's not, you know, like, it's not just all about, feel, you know, God makes me feel good, you know, like, or that, you know, God is all about butterflies and, you know, and just happiness all the time, you know,
this is something I feel like I like have to bring up. I was watching this video yesterday, and you might know where I'm going with this, but it's this girl who she's battling cancer. Well, I say girl, she's 30. And, she was on like America's Got Talent. She's got all these, like great little videos though that I've seen of like clips where she is just like, man, she's just so positive in the midst of her battle. But the video that I saw yesterday was her saying, you know, all these emotions are a part of me. I've got fear, pain, I've got courage, joy, love, I've got all these things. And she said, it's like I'm sitting in a car, and what's going to drive the car? I'm going to have, you know, courage drive the car, love, joy drive the car. She said, those other things though are a part of me too. Fear and pain, those things are a part of me. I'm not going to kick them out of the car.
They're still in the car.
They're still in the car with me.
But they're not driving the car.
They can sit in the back seat. They can, you know, give me ideas. They can tell me what they think, but they're not going to decide where we go. Mm-hmm. And so us just kind of talking about this again and me having that on my mind, and we've talked about before the complexities of just like human nature and emotions and how we can hold both joy and grief at the same time. And I think this is just another great visual of God's own nature of, he can hold his, you know, his just anger and also his compassion and forgiveness and kindness and loyal love. Like, he can hold all those things, but he drives with his loyal love and compassion.
Yeah. What? So this is like, I sat and watched with the kids. What is that movie? Pixar movie that's got...
Inside Out.
Inside Out. I mean, this is... Pixar nailed this.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, we think that everything... You know, it's like this idea of like everything's about joy and everything is... Like, you know, the main character in it is trying to, the main character, Joy, the emotion, Joy, is trying to be like, oh, I want this for my person, that they just always experience joy. And kind of the, you know, where it goes is like, listen, life is complicated, and it is a mixture of, you know, like, joy and sadness aren't two separate things. Like, mm-hmm. you know, sadness sometimes, you know, results in a joy, you know? So like these mm-hmm. two things aren't separated. They're one, you know, like one leads to another. Mm-hmm. And so I like, that's kind of the plot of the Pixar film Inside Out. You know, so like we know this, but like we just don't, like whenever we read this, we're like, oh, you know, like God can't be that way. No, God
burn
is
burned like, with anger and also very forgiving.
We are that way because God is that way.
Yeah.
And so we've got to learn, like we need to learn to behave like God does, you know, not just always, you know, it needs to be, I think, compassion wrapping up our justice, you know, mm-hmm. like it needs, our any justice that we want needs to be wrapped up in our compassion. And I think that's the way we talked about this whenever we did some of the Minor Prophets, of like, listen, his wrath and his anger is not for the sake of wrath and anger. It's always has a future pointing, you know, goal to it that I'm going to build up from here. You know, like one of the, you know, common ideas of like, I'm going to, you know, everything's going to be stubble, but it's not so that for the sake of it being stubble, it's so that it can be built back up. Mm-hmm. And so that's always the way that I think that God is portrayed, is that it's not that he doesn't have it, but for the sake, what he uses it for, is so that he can build back up, so that he can start new, and build something good from it. And so I think that's, we just got to square with that. You know, we got to let that be something that we work through and struggle through a little bit to understand God the way that he desires to be understood. So before we close this out, I wanted to take a minute and just see how I love whenever I can see things in the New Testament and the way that they pick up themes and continue themes forward from other books, or see how not just like that they're picking out certain verses and repeating them as if it's, you know, like all the Old Testament is just like single line prophetic, you know, at, you know, lines for, oh, look, this is how Jesus came. Like, that's not really what, whenever Jesus says that the all of the Moses and the prophets and the Psalms, all these things, all the things that it said about me, he's not really talking, I don't think he's really talking about these one-liners of like, oh, Messiah will do this, Messiah will do that. It's really a story arc of like, that. Hey, this has always been pointing in this direction. I hope we've done a good job of pointing that out, of that this is where the story has been going, but I'm going to try to help a little bit with seeing that more fully. I think that John very much picks up on these themes that we see fulfilled or come to its first completion in Exodus chapter 40. He picks it right up in chapter 1. I'm just going to read in the middle of John chapter 1. He's in John chapter 1, verses 14 through 18. I'm going to read that. And it says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelled among us, and we saw his glory, glory as the one and only from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified about him and cried out, saying, 'This one was he about whom I said, the one who comes after me is ahead of me, because he existed before me. For from his fullness we have all received, in grace after grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came about through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The one and only God, the one who is in the bosom of the Father, that one has made him known.'" And so I think that John is very much picking up on the Exodus theme and saying, you remember what happened in the Exodus, that God came and dwelled among us. Well, there's a new and greater Exodus here. That not only has God come and dwelt, he uses the word here, I think the Greek word is skeno, which is literally tabernacled. Like, it's the same word that's used for the tabernacle. That he tabernacled among us, that he dwelled among us, he took up residence among us. So he picks up on the Exodus theme and says, this is not just the tent of assembly that we had in the Exodus narrative, but now the Word has become flesh and dwelt among us. This is what Peter, I think this is Peter Enns, wrote this. The use of skeno or skene for tabernacle, the intention for John is that Jesus be seen as the new and improved tabernacle or temple. This is not to reject the old temple versions of the Old Testament versions of the temple as merely ritualistic and now thankfully done away with. It is rather to understand the reality to which the Old Testament structures pointed, a reality that reaches its climax in Christ. Hence, John continues in John 1:14, "We have seen his glory, the glory that resided above the ark in the most holy place, to which the high priest alone has access once a year, is now walking in the streets of Jerusalem for all to see, a truly portable tabernacle." So what John picks up this theme of that God dwells among us, and he says, look, you know, this Jesus that I'm about to tell you about in this story, he is God in the flesh, and he has brought this Exodus story to a whole new level. And it's not undoing it. It's showing that, look, this is the way that it was always going. This is the way that everything was pointing. There was this desire for God to dwell among his people. And there at the end of it, I mentioned that the second theme of Exodus is that God make himself known. God is making himself known. In 18, you know, it says that no one has seen God at any time, the one and only God, the one who is in the bosom of the Father, that one has made him known. So Jesus is the way through this story. He is making him more fully known in a way that he hasn't been known before, just like what was done in the Exodus story. And so there's lots of ways that we could show that each of the gospel authors are saying, look, this is a new Exodus. Luke would outright say it, that in the transfiguration scene, that he would say, hey, he was talking with Moses and Elijah about his Exodus, which is, again, more than leaving Egypt. It's about God dwelling among his people. And how is Jesus going to achieve that? And so the way that the gospel authors look at it, they say this is a new Exodus. It's even greater Exodus than before. But we have to know the first one. I think we have to know the first Exodus in order to understand the second Exodus, mm-hmm. to better understand the second Exodus. And so I think that's a really cool thing. And then I'm going to do one more reading. This is actually from the culmination, the climax of the entire Bible. This is where everything is going. This is where the whole story has gone since Genesis chapter 3. The fall of man and what God has been desiring to do in and among his people and through his people. It says, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea did not exist any longer. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling of God is with humanity, and he will take up residence with them. And they will be his people, and God himself will be with them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death will not exist any longer. And mourning or wailing or pain will not exist any longer. The former things have passed away.'" And so as we trace the Exodus theme, I just wanted to kind of pick two pinpoints of saying, look, you know, the gospel authors are saying Jesus is the new and greater Exodus. And what is it for? Why is God coming and dwelling among his people? And he's doing all of this so that we can get to this point, too, for Revelation 21, that God in his fullness is dwelling in and among his people. This is where the whole story of the Bible goes. And it finishes the way that it started, that God dwells with his people. And there in the middle, we're like working out how that happens. Mm-hmm. And the Exodus is the first like real step for God to come and dwell among his people. I have one more thing that I think I'm gonna finish this with. Do you have any other thoughts on that? Okay, so I'm gonna go back to Exodus 40 at the end of it. This is actually a note from a guy named Michael Morales who I've referenced quite a few times. This is his, I think this is from his book, Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord? And commenting on God coming and dwelling among his people, I just thought that this would be kind of a good ender for the book. He says, "The maker of the heaven and the earth, who had once walked among humanity in the midst of the olden days before the flood, returns once more, now in history, through a covenant relationship with Israel mediated by Moses. When the glory of Yahweh descends upon the tabernacle, therefore, a historic, cataclysmic event takes place. The God of heaven in all his thunderous majesty has arrived, the advent of Yahweh, to dwell with his people on earth, Eden regained."